From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, the Menominee Valley's newest park opened last weekend amid protests about the many thousands of pounds of ammonia that nearby Palermo's Pizza has in storage. WUWM's Susan Benz reports. Then we travel to Wanakee to learn about a music education technique from Switzerland. A local historian pens a novel steeped in the real-life events of the American Civil War.
It's taking what really was the case and just turning it up at one little slight notch further than historically was true. It's real close to what could have happened.
And discover parts of Milwaukee you didn't know existed during the second Amazing Milwaukee Race on bikes.
It opens up the whole city to us. We can basically take you to really remote locations or really niche places.
Stay tuned for Lake Effect, coming your way after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. Last weekend, a celebration for a project considered a huge win for the environment was slightly marred by protests. But it wasn't the transformation of a 24-acre former rail yard in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley into a park that was at issue. As Three Bridges Park officially opened its bridges last Saturday, protesters showed up to broadcast that a tenant just below the park has been cited for Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, violations. Their target is Palermo's Pizza, one of the first companies to bring its operation into the valley. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz was on the scene, watched the events unfold, and filed this report.
Lots of people were queued up at the park's easternmost bridge, the one that links the Mitchell Park domes to a series of trails, one for biking, another for pedestrians, and then the vast man-made terrain that's destined to become an outdoor classroom along the Menominee River. As we formed a human and bicycle parade, strategically designed to meet up with people launching from bridges 2 and 3, a few individuals quietly worked the crowd, passing out flyers.
Palermo's Pizza Factory is right next door. There's 30,000 pounds of ammonia. The OSHA federal government has cited them for the safety hazards. They're fighting that. It's exactly what caused the big disaster in West Texas.
The protesters' words faded as we were swept into the crowd along the sun-drenched landscape. The ceremony opened with Menominee River Partners Executive Director Laura Bray's welcome. That group, along with a bundle of public and private partners, pulled off this project, along with enticing businesses to repopulate the once blighted valley below.
It just takes my breath away, and I hope it takes your breath away.
A blast, and then a voice echoed through the park. The amplified words of Brian Rothgary bounced along the native plant-seeded hills.
30,000 pounds of ammonia that is on site, 100 feet away.
The union organizer has been more than a little involved in the safety and strike issues that have embroiled the pizza operation for months. In a flash, Rothgary was spirited away, and the ceremony continued. A stream of partners and dignitaries took their turn at the official microphone. When he stepped up, Forest County Pottawatomie Chairman Harold Gus Frank acknowledged American citizens' right to share views, including Rothgary.
Had his concerns heard by hundreds of people, and for years and years, I believe that the responsible citizens for the city of Milwaukee was trying to have their voices heard, saying, we need to do something in that valley to clean it up.
The ribbon cutting achieved, the crowd slowly dispersed, some to check out kayaks moored on the river, others to grab free ice cream or to have their face painted. Erica Wolf pressed a press packet into my hand.
There's a letter from the steelworkers saying, what's up with this discrepancy? There's the
volunteer motored in from Madison and says she's one of 30 protesters on the scene. She deems OSHA's call on Palermo's urgent.
What's going on is that there's been discovered a huge discrepancy in reporting. They have 30,000 pounds of ammonia on site here, and they've been cited for serious safety procedure training violations. And On the city's record, they have their worst case scenario that only 1,300 pounds could leak and or explode and cause a problem. But we know there's 30,000 pounds on site because they've reported that to the EPA. So what we're wondering is why is this discrepancy there? Because the difference, I mean, though they're both catastrophic situations, the difference is huge because 1,300 pounds, a leak would, you know, within 1 minute would affect a 1.2-mile radius from right where we're standing. Right here you can see the building. And if it was, if 30,000 pounds were to explode or leak, that would affect a 6-mile radius within 1 minute, which is all the way to the lake, and then in the other, in every direction, right? And so we're saying this is a public safety risk for the entire city of Milwaukee.
Evan Zeppos dismisses Wolf's assessment as outrageous claims and scare tactics. I reached the Palermo's spokesperson by phone. Zeppos says the anhydrous ammonia, 29,500 pounds of it, used at the pizza factory, is a component of the company's sophisticated closed-loop refrigeration system. He adds it's 7 years old and they've never had a problem.
It's monitored 24 hours a day. We have an emergency response plan in place that protects the employees in the community. And if there were any sense of true seriousness of these concerns as people who are trying to hurt the company try to make it, you know there would be a lot more attention from the regulatory authorities.
Zeppos says since OSHA notified the company on May 17th, Palermo's has been providing the agency with information. He describes OSHA's concerns as administrative, not operational.
It wasn't that OSHA said there's a problem with emissions or anything like that. They wanted further documentation on our training programs. They wanted further documentation on our system review. Not that it was bad. Not that there was something wrong. Not that there was a leak. Not that there was anything else. We take it seriously, though. I don't want to minimize it.
Representatives from OSHA said they were not able to grant an interview on the active case, but states Palermo's Pizza is contesting the violations. That could be resolved through an agreement. However, it opens the door to a possible formal hearing process. Whenever more than 10,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia are stored or used, additional OSHA safety standards click in. The agency wants to make sure workers know how to protect themselves, including how to recognize a leak in the system. According to OSHA's website, refrigerant-grade anhydrous ammonia is classified as non-flammable. However, quote, ammonia vapor in high concentrations will burn. It is unlikely that such concentrations will occur except in confined spaces or in the proximity of large spills, end quote. In its citation notification to Palermo's, OSHA called for violation abatement by August 16th. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz filed that report on last weekend's protest against Palermo's Pizza at Three Bridges Park in the Menominee Valley. Musicians from Wisconsin and beyond gathered just north of Madison this summer to learn about a music education technique from Switzerland. Lake Effect's Amy Kiley stopped by the Wisconsin Center for Music Education in Wanakee to experience Dahlkrows.
This is not a typical music class. Stacks of hula hoops and bags of colorful balls lie under tables overflowing with percussion instruments. Tables and chairs line the walls, but they're empty. Adult participants are in the middle of the room, dancing barefoot. This is a Dahlkrows workshop. Swiss composer and teacher Emile Jacques Dahlkrows created this movement-based music education technique to give his students a better understanding of the pitches and rhythms they were performing. He wanted them to hear music better and to have a physical understanding of their art. In this exercise, students are singing a song while moving to changing meters. They're dividing the beats first into three sets of two, the meter 3-4, and then into two sets of 6 or 6-8. Teaching today's class is Dr. Kathy Thompson. Until recently, she was head of the Dahlkrows Society of America and editor of the American Dahlkrows Journal.
Dahlkrows eurythmics really involves three different branches. Eurythmics, which is the movement and music part, and solfège, which is the singing and hearing and the oral training, and then improvisation, both with gestures and on instruments and with voice, all meant to be intertwined.
Thompson sits at a keyboard to demonstrate how Dalcroze inspires movement that reflects a kinetic musical understanding.
The musical body can teach the mind things that the mind can't learn on its own. And so if I want people to feel a beat, I can have them walk to the beat. If I want kids to run, we were building a house and we had these large imaginary cranes. You can get great movement from kids that you would never get. I had them do, for example, a ball passing exercise. And they were able to pass a ball, and I didn't have to say anything.
Thompson says once students can feel tempo, rhythm, and even pitch, they can then approach music with more comprehension. Joan Parisi notes this connection helps not only performers, but also audience members. She's a student in today's Dalcroze workshop, but she's been a music teacher for decades.
Dalcroze starts off with listening to the music, feeling the music, and then works into reading the music. So even students that might not be able to read the music still can have a great appreciation for it because they understand it better.
Cecil Salcedo teaches music at a Montessori school in the Philippines. Musicians have spread Dalcroze worldwide, and Salcedo uses it with her students back home. But the workshops aren't as prevalent as those for other educational methods. Today's workshop is a way for Salcedo to freshen her skills while she's in the U.S. for a performance with some of her students. She notes that Dalcroze is a fun way to experience music, and not just for kids.
I feel like a child again, a student. I truly experience what the kids are doing in our schools. It's so magical.
For people who want to experience a concert with a dose of Dalcroze, Thompson offers this advice.
Call the management in advance and say, rip out the seats and let us move.
Back in the middle of the room, that idea seems to work well for today's participants. For Lake Effect, I'm Amy Kiley.
In addition to reporting for Lake Effect, Amy Kiley serves as a local choral conductor. There are links to the Dalcroze Society of America and the Wisconsin Center for Music Education at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a short break now, and then a local historian pens a novel that's steeped in the real-life events of the American Civil War. We'll be back with that in just a moment on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The spring of 1862 marked a ratcheting of Civil War tensions between the Union capital, Washington, D.C., and the Confederate seat of power in Richmond, Virginia, which was helped in no small part by their relative proximity. Union General George McClellan would make an attempt to capture the Confederate government and army base during his Springtime Peninsula campaign. It would end in failure by July after a string of six fierce and bloody fights known as the Seven Days Battle. McClellan's inability to take Richmond in this campaign allowed the war to continue for years. All the while this campaign was going on, spies from both the North and the South were doing their parts to aid their causes and thwart the efforts of their opponents. A new historical novel tells the tale of one of these subversive plots, and it's up to a young Union artillery lieutenant and a grizzled New York journalist to stop it. Richmond's Bloody Road is written by Milwaukee author Thomas Martin Saturday, or as Lake Effect listeners might know him, Thomas Martin Sabotke. He's the voice of our Civil War series. Sabotke tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why he turned to fiction even as he remained true to history.
At one point, I decided I wanted to have our characters in the first novel uncover two Confederate double agents who worked out of Richmond. And I was digging around for background in some books about Union intelligence and found there were two Confederate double agents that were found out. So the facts of history actually met fiction 100% dead on. And that kind of staggered me. So I have to be careful that I don't, in creating a fictional story, run into real history too much.
Well, tell us where we are, at what point in the war we are at the beginning of Richmond's Bloody Road.
Yeah, this is just before the Union Army of the Potomac with George McClellan is finally going to move out of Washington, D.C., over 100,000 men. It's March of 1862. In the West, there is some success going on with Grant at Fort Donelson and, you know, and so on, and Shiloh's weeks away. But in the East, things have not been going well at all, and McClellan has done really nothing. And All Quiet on the Potomac becomes a hit song because they're not doing much. And then, of course, the two characters that are the prime characters in what will be a series of novels meet in rather unusual circumstances.
Well, let's talk about your two protagonists. I want to start with Benjamin Eaton. Did you want to make him representative of your average Union soldier? Or was he kind of a composite of a few different figures you had in mind, or totally made out of whole cloth?
He would be a composite, but he was I wanted to have a young officer who would be with one of the classes of 1861 at West Point, who either were thrown right out into the Army into a Great War, you know, right as soon as they graduated, or had their last year cut short and were sent out there. And Eaton's character is really that stoic character where he's always going to do his duty. He really is fearless for his life. Devoted to the Union all the way, but he has an unusual background. His family's really from Tidewater, Maryland, right across the Potomac from Virginia. And in his grandfather's generation, they owned some slaves. And his manner of speech is a Virginia drawl. And in fact, the rest of his family is in Fairfax County across the Potomac. And they are slaveholders still. And there's been an estrangement. And he constantly has to fight with people who think somehow he shouldn't be in the Union Army because he sounds so Southern and he's wearing blue. And he is in the regular artillery. He's a regular, and he's commanding that little bit of the regular United States Army that existed at the beginning of the Civil War, not volunteers. So he's a thoroughgoing professional, and he has this place within him, though, is a great weakness, just like any great character would in a Greek tragedy almost. And that is that at Henry House Hill, he was with his battery as a lieutenant, and all six guns were historically taken. They were Ricketts' battery, and he had a horrible experience in that battle, and it shakes him to the core, and he's fighting in command of Union troops in any battle with that memory. It just, you know, these recurring dreams and the savagery of it all. And it's something he has to overcome. But otherwise, he's that stock character that reins in my other character somehow.
Speaking of reining in other characters, I believe that would apply most appropriately to Sanford Ellis. He is a reporter out of New York. I know you just had an article published on war correspondence. How much did you draw on that for modeling this character, Sanford Ellis?
Well, I've studied a great deal about the war correspondence in the Civil War. I certainly did model Sanford Ellis after, again, a composite of a lot of reporters. I just made him more irresponsible than most. That's part of the problem. He's from Boston, and he's a Boston Brahmin, Harvard-educated, lives on Beacon Street on Beacon Hill. He drops names all over the place. He is a thoroughgoing womanizer, a cad of the worst type.
And a drunk.
And a drunk, yes. He likes alcohol, and he gets drunk when he has not a whole lot to do. It's odd. He ended up going to work for the New York Herald newspaper, and he is a thoroughgoing Unionist, but he's also an abolitionist. And the New York Herald is Tammany Hall Democrat and very sympathetic to the Southern situation. And one of the fascinating things is that here he's working for a newspaper that is completely opposite editorially from what he believes. But he explains early in the book that, well, he was looking for some sort of job, and that was the one that was open at the time.
So how did these two characters from such different parts of the country with such different attitudes and kind of personalities, how did they get thrown together?
Well, they're both in the same Washington, D.C. bordello at the same time. That's pretty much it. A place called Mrs. Weston's Academy for Ladies.
Uh-huh.
But the education that these women have is distinctly, shall we say, illegal. Of course, this is a place full of cigar smoke, clanking glasses, and it's just a wild place. There were hundreds of these bordellos that sprang up in Washington as soon as the Civil War began. I know it's rather scandalous. Most people don't want to talk about that, but that would be the truth. And in fact, 13th and D Streets was about the worst neighborhood for these things. And today, I believe the Smithsonian Institution has taken over that property, if I'm not mistaken. So that's kind of, if you're walking through some of the newer parts of the Smithsonian, you may be walking over my fictional Mrs. Weston's Academy for Ladies. But they have a fight. They literally get to it. And one of the things that staggers Ellis is that this young artillery lieutenant is able to get him up against a wall with his hand on his throat, and in a position where this little much smaller lieutenant, he didn't think this guy has this kind of a starch behind him. And they both kind of have a truce and decide that it's not worth the fighting over. And they leave the bordello only to hear the barking of a dog from in back.
And that's when they discover this dead body right near the restrooms, if you will.
That's right. Out on the woodpile is a man in a black frock coat who is obviously dead. And as the body is being examined by Sanford Ellis, Ellis tells him that he's done a lot of what's called night work. Apparently before the war, as a reporter, they stuck him on the police beat, which a paper like the New York Herald really made its money as a tabloid almost. They liked to cover murders and all kinds of seamy underbelly kind of stories for New York City. So he's had a lot of experience actually running down murders and many other things, and he's worked with what sad excuses there were in those days for police departments. And he is a bit of a sleuth.
Now, as we follow these two characters as they're investigating this murder and finding out that it has more and more to do with the Confederate cause, we meet a series of characters that at first present themselves as the complete opposite of what they end up being. And I'm immediately thinking of Sarah.
Sarah is apparently to Eaton's command. They come in the dark while they're in the Virginia Peninsula later in that year when the army has moved and is trying to capture Richmond in the summer of 1862. And Sarah has brought a little boy to freedom, but she has a message for any Union unit she can find that is rather startling. But I had an awareness that I wanted to have some African-American characters that during the war were doing a lot more on their own initiative, which would have been actually for at least a portion of the African-American community in Richmond. True, there were African-Americans who were aiding the Union as the war developed. There were those who were running away. But there was also a group of free blacks in Richmond who, although they were considered inferior to any white person, were carving out niches for themselves. And I wanted these characters to have the abilities and initiative and having a sense of their own identities that would really run counter to what people would assume slaves would be.
Now, Sarah helps bring Ellis and Eaton into the company of the Danger Sisters, and I want to have you talk a little bit about these characters and what role they end up playing in this mystery that they're trying to solve.
Sarah's been sent out to find them because these two Richmond Confederate ladies want to help the Union cause. And, of course, our two main characters, when they meet the Dandridge sisters, find that they're both under 30, both extremely attractive. And they're especially drawn to Elizabeth Dandridge, who runs counter to a lot of things that would be a Confederate lady of Richmond at that time. I really got onto the Dandridge sisters from history. There was a real person named Elizabeth Van Loo, who gave enormous amounts of intelligence through the lines to the Union side as the war progressed. She was actually living in a mansion on Grace Street in Richmond. That's where I have their mansion with her mother. But I just changed that and I made the other person a sibling. And I guess you're trying to figure out, well, how would these women hide their Union proclivities? And of course, what they do is that Elizabeth, the way she does it is that she is such a feminist, such a suffragist, that and so independent and fierce that a lot of the gentlemen of Richmond who would want to marry such a beautiful woman just, you know, can't stand her. And so that's her way of doing it. Jenny hides her Union proclivities by being the opposite of her sister, so conventional. But she has an illness, you know, that limits her marriage prospects. And they do have a heart, these women. They are very strong in collecting money for Confederate soldiers who are wounded. And that's a real humanitarian thing that they sincerely are devoted to. The way Elizabeth Van Loo stayed out of trouble was she also cultivated an image. She was like the Dandridges. She did help any Union prisoners as well as Confederate men who were ill. But she was known as something like Crazy Mary. She kind of acted a little strange in public. And so if she had said something or done something that might look like she was disloyal, people actually put it off to, well, she's nuts. Don't worry about it. And she actually got through a lot of it, particularly at the end of the war, with that reputation.
Were there spies who actually were able to get behind the lines at Richmond to be on the Confederate side, Union spies like Ellis and Eaton end up pretty much becoming?
Yes, there were spies on both sides getting into Washington. I think the infiltration of our nation's capital on the Union side, Washington, D.C., was a lot more extensive. The Confederates were much more successful because that city, Washington, was really just across the Potomac from Virginia. And most people that lived in Washington all through the war were born and bred Southerners. And in fact, John Hay, Lincoln's secretary, noted in his diary that any time a Union defeat was announced, you would hear Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag on pianos up and down the streets of Washington as hundreds, if not thousands, of Washingtonians celebrated every Confederate victory. So if you're Abraham Lincoln or you're anybody in Washington on the Union side, you become aware very quickly of the fact that the enemy is in your midst. And how many of those people who are openly celebrating Union defeats would be excellent choices for espionage, and there were many.
Well, so what's next for Ellis and Eaton?
Well, my next novel is entitled The Lamentations of Uriah. This is a continuation of this problem with General McClellan and certain generals around him. And if the first novel had a secret or piece of information that could turn the direction of the war, this will be dwarfed by what appears in the second novel. And much to my surprise, when I did the historical background research I wanted to do, it actually fits my novel plot that I put together that I thought was so wild and crazy. And really what it is, it's taking what really was the case and just turning it up that one little slight notch further than historically was true. It's real close to what could have happened.
Well, Thomas Martin Sabaki, thanks for coming in and sharing Richmond's Bloody Road with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thomas Martin Saturday's first historical novel in the Ellis Eaton series is Richmond's Bloody Road, published by Moving Train Books. The second book will be published in the coming months. Saturday is the pen name of our own Civil War correspondent Thomas Martin Sabaki. You can listen in on Lake Effect Weekend to hear him discuss the impact of Gettysburg. Coming up next, the amazing Milwaukee Race on Bikes turns two this year. We'll hear about this year's race next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks for joining us. Tonight marks the start of the River West 24, a day-long bike race that celebrates community and biking in urban environments. But if you missed registering to cycle for that race or can't cheer on the participants this weekend, don't worry. Another bike race around Milwaukee is coming up in just a couple of weeks. The Amazing Milwaukee Race on Bikes takes teams of two on an urban bike adventure while testing their speed, stamina, and smarts. This is the second race on bikes designed by director Milwaukeean Adam Baus. We've previously talked with him about his foot race version of the event, which is modeled after television's The Amazing Race. Like that show's format, Baus's competitions require racers to complete a course full of physical challenges, brain teasers, and clues to solve while taking them to unique locations around the city. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce even participated and lost badly. Baus tells Lecce what is different about the race this August, besides the obvious use of bicycles.
It is the Amazing Milwaukee Race on Bikes, and it is our second event. We had our first one last summer. And it's basically just like our other races, except you get to get from location to location on your bike.
Now, I would imagine that that gives you a little bit more freedom when you're planning the route and even the challenges that people get to do when they go from location to location.
Yes, absolutely. It opens up the whole city to us because we can basically take you to really remote locations or really niche places. It just opens up everything to us, and it makes it so much fun to contact these businesses and be like, how can we get here? And we can do things that you can't do by car or by bus, like the bike trails, bike lanes, various different kinds of streets, and we even have a few secret passageways, too.
Well, drawing on last year's race, what were some of the places you were able to take participants because they were traveling by bike that the on-foot version of the Amazing Milwaukee Race wasn't really able to conceivably go to?
Well, a great example would have been a good leg of the race last year where we got people to 37th and Pierce Street, which is where the Wisconsin Bike Federation office is, also where the new Urban Ecology Center is, and there's that little bridge that connects to Canal Street. We used that a few years ago on the foot race, but last year you could continue on the Hank Aaron State Trail, come up back behind and through Miller Park, and then get up to Doyne Park, which is on the other side of Wisconsin Avenue. And then as you ride through Doyne Park, all of a sudden you spill out onto the Honey Creek Parkway. That would have been far too great a distance to ask people to walk. But on bikes, you get to just see all these neat little trails that take you through these huge landmarks inside the city.
And I bet places, the little connections that people might not have realized, you know, that they would be able to travel on a regular basis.
Yeah, and we can even show off more of those. We can do more of those. I mean, on a foot race, we might be able to show one just because it might be really far off a basic path or something like that. But on bikes, we can just load up the whole course with all kinds of fun things like that. Another really great example would have been last year. I mean, when you use the trail, you're using things that aren't a regular street. And the Oakleaf Trail on the east side is a perfect example. So we were at the Urban Ecology Center, the main campus at Riverside. We were using the track at Riverside High School. And then you could just get on the path and take that all the way to the lake. You know, that's just a great bike ride. So that's another example of places and ways that we can do things that are totally different from our foot race.
But it still fits in with the mission, the idea that the race is to help people see parts of the city that they've never seen before.
Absolutely. Yeah, we love it when people come away from the race and they're like, I didn't know where any of those places were. I never even knew any of those places existed.
Now, you're talking about all of these far-flung locations you're able to get to on bike, but I wonder how far should participants expect that they'll be traveling?
We have two routes for our bike race. This year, we have a 30-mile route and a 15-mile route.
I just fell over. That's a pretty long distance. Or is that maybe for people who are used to bicycling, not that bad?
Well, we had even longer ones last year, so they were really ambitious. Last year, we did a 40-mile route and a 20-mile route. And then when we routed the short route, we were running into some safety issues. And I remember the day we tested, we were like, yeah, it's actually 5 miles over. And we were like, well, what can you do, you know? So our participants last year were amazing troopers. I mean, we also ran into a serious weather issue last year. So we're really hoping that won't happen again. So this year, we right away, that was one of the first lessons we learned. We were like, we need to lower the length of the course a little bit, make it a little bit more accessible. And coincidentally, it's kind of amazing, but our registrations right now, more people have signed up for the long route than the short route.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing that it's probably attracting a different kind of participant, people who are used to traveling those kinds of distances on their bicycles versus, you know, folks who don't mind running around 5 miles in the city on foot.
Yeah. This race particularly attracts even more the active type, you know, people who just are active and they're out and about. I mean, and one of the beauties is our event is in August, so if you only bike during the summer, like most of us do, you're probably in pretty good shape. And 15 miles, when you break it up into 10, 12 pieces, gets really short pretty fast. And especially when you got other people and you have a teammate and you have to have a team of two. So you get to spend the day with them too. And I'll be interested to see how fast the first, you know, how what time the first place comes in this year.
Now, so, are tandem bicycles allowed?
Absolutely. Of course. So we encourage our tandem friends to join us on the race. I mean, I'm a tandem bike rider, so we always encourage people to get out of tandem.
In our last interview, we talked a lot about how you design the different challenges. I wonder if it's different when you have participants arriving on bicycle versus foot?
Well, one thing is we can use larger areas, or we can definitely, we're much more prone to getting into the county park system. I think last year's race used like 9 different parks that were all over the place. So, and mainly because it's a safe route, I mean, if it has a bike trail or something to get through it, but also there's just a lot of neat locations that way. We don't do as many like pinpointed small business locations just because you're going to get overloaded with bikes. We don't cap our attendance so we can have a lot of people on bikes showing up. And it's one thing when you have a lot of people on foot, but now they have these bikes with them and there's one per person. So that can muck up a lot of problems. So we try to, you know, we're very keen on how to route this and find ways that make it as smooth for all purposes and our traffic routing and stuff like that. So
now I know you've also introduced a new clue format.
Well, we did it last year as opposed to how we do our foot races, because we do our clues in sequential order. So for our foot races, you know, we're used to printing off a million little pieces of paper, and you get each little piece of paper and you get clue one, and you get clue two, clue three. Well, obviously people on bikes don't want to deal with that. And then in order to make things valid, you don't want to have all the little pieces of paper at the finish line, because even though you might have ran a great race, you're probably going to lose one or something like that. And we just don't want to create that problem for you. So last year what we did is we made them so that they were numbered and you could take pictures of them, and then you would just show the pictures at the end. We ran into a lot of problems with that because it was raining last year, and some people's phones or cameras, you know, it had water damage and stuff like that. So this year we're going to change it to a manifest format like the River West 24. We'll have a lanyard, we'll have a laminated manifest, and at each stop, once you've completed the task, you're going to get a punch. So basically, you show up at the finish line, we see that you have all your punches, we enter in your team number, we have your official time, and you're done. And what we'll do is we'll still have our clues like last year. We'll have them large form printed. I want to print them on 11 by 17 or larger paper so that multiple people can read them at once. And it will tell you exactly what you need to do, but you don't have to take pictures of the clues this year. So it'll allow you to get from location to location, point to point, as you need to. We also will have the maps. We did a lot of maps last year, and so this year we'll use our Milwaukee by Bike map. And so that if you have a map, you can just write down exactly where you need to go and see how you have to get there.
Now, I have a question about that, because mm-hmm. if you have a bicycle, you could detour mm-hmm. if you wanted from the route, the prescribed route. How do you make sure that the participants are actually going on the route you want them to take?
Well, we run into some trouble, and that's also a huge concern of mine, because unlike our foot race where we know once you get on the bus will kind of take you where you need to go. You could be lost within 20 feet of where you just left. And so we get a little concerned about that. And that's one of the reasons why you don't ride solo. You have a teammate, so you're not alone. But what we try to do is that within our routing, want to find the safest or the most scenic route. So we just pull our checkpoints where you have to find our volunteers. We stretch them out as far as we can. When we put together the bike race last year, I thought it would just be great if, because we were trying something new with this bike format, that we would use a lot of the same locations that we used in the past 3 years. Partially because then we've already have a pre-existing relationship with all these businesses. Pretty much get to do the same thing. And we knew we were going to be attracting a whole new group of people compared to, you know, if we're using locations from the first race, there's a good chance that nobody's done them before. So I really wanted to go back to the Menominee Valley Passage at 37th Street and Pierce, and we needed to get to Washington Park. Now, there are a number of ways that you can do that, but on bike, we were running into the problem that we know people who are really cutthroat about the race, they're going to try to find the shortest route they can. And the shortest route for that would have been Holly Road. Now, Holly Road is just bad for bicyclists on so many levels. One, it's a really steep hill. Two, cars drive rather fast on Holly Road, and there is absolutely no room for bikes. So to solve that problem, we coax you into a certain route, and we make you have to go get this next clue at this place. So we pulled people up through Miller Park, through and around Doyne Park, and then from Doyne Park that spits you out onto the Oak Leaf Trail and the Honey Creek Parkway, and that will pretty much take you and deliver you to Hart Park in Wauwatosa over at 68th and State Street. So we put a volunteer there to pull you over there. And then from there, now we can get you from 68th and State to Washington Park by just going a little bit. And then we gave people directions. And all of a sudden you get through Washington Circle and Valeet Street. You get through Valeet Street and get to ride through beautiful Wauwatosa, and then all of a sudden you're there at Washington Circle and there's a bike lane that delivers you right into Washington Park. So we found a safer option, a rather beautiful option, a much more gradual hill. Milwaukee has a lot more hills than you think, and it just made things a lot safer. Now, we did run into the problem that's why we added a lot more miles onto that short route, but it was a lot safer, and we were a lot happier with how that could work. And that was one of those sections where just by going a few blocks in a certain way, maybe you didn't realize these streets actually connected you. You all of a sudden, you don't realize that these two neighborhoods are actually a lot closer together and they're a lot more accessible.
Adam, how much did you have to ride around in order to find these routes?
I like to ride. So during the summer, my work schedule is a little bit less, so I try to ride as much as possible. And I work it out a lot on Google Maps with the bike option, and then I just go test it and test it and test it and test it. So anytime I can, if I'm riding and I commute by bike during the summer when the weather's nice, I will go out of my way to take any part of a leg that might be on the race and see if I can work out what the streets are going to be ahead of time. So, I use my Milwaukee bike map a lot. It's an excellent resource. So anytime I want to get from place to place, I pull up the map and I see what bike lanes are suggested, and then I just go ride it.
Now, this is obviously your second Amazing Milwaukee race by bike, mm-hmm. but this is your fifth?
It's our sixth big event. We have had four Amazing Milwaukee races, and now this will be our second Amazing Milwaukee race on bikes.
You know, I would imagine you're learning something each time you put this event on. What have you learned since the first Amazing Milwaukee race by bike?
Oh, that is such a great question. There are so many little things that we've learned. One, we have to be really careful how we craft our clues and how hard we make them, because we've definitely made some really hard puzzles in the past. And, you know, some people really like that, but I think like anybody, if you're working on something after a half an hour and you're not getting it, something needs to change. So we learned a lot about that. Last year with the race on bikes, we learned that we have to work with a smaller distance for this. I mean, just by doing the event several times, I've learned a lot about how to prep my volunteers. And this last race that we had in April was by far the smoothest. We really broke our volunteer orientation into like four parts, and we had to do activity test days, we had to do route test days, bus test days, and then the final big orientation where we walk through the whole thing. And so, of course, our volunteer force, I'm learning too, we have to keep bulking it up. We want to get as many people interested in being on the back end as much as the front end. The more, the better, as long as we really get them into how the race has to operate. And our volunteers have a great time. So I would say those are some really big things that I've learned. And just by doing that, I think the race has continued to get smoother and smoother. And as we get more people and as we're growing, we try to make all the processes of the preparations just more streamlined. This last year, it changed the clue format again so that they're all the same size, just because it was so much easier to prepare.
Does that organization on the front end help when it comes to, you know, unpredictable variables like the weather?
Oh, yeah. Well, last year, if you remember, it never rained all summer until the day of the amazing Milwaukee race on bikes. We started at about noon, and at 1:15, a massive thunderstorm and hailstorm came down on all of our lovely participants. So, we just try to tell our volunteers to bunker down and hold out, because a lot of people kind of find that, I mean, I love those participants who are like, no, I really liked it with the rain. It was so much fun, you know, so much more adventure. I think our volunteers, we are very prepared. We like to be organized, and so that we're ready for anything that may happen and we can deal with any situations to give our participants the best time possible. I also really like to make my jobs for my volunteers as easy as it possibly can be. So we try to take the brunt on the upper staff end and make it as smooth and as fun, because they're giving their whole day to us too. So.
Now, for those who are listening to this and thinking, this sounds really cool, but I cannot bike 15, 20 miles, are there still ways to get involved?
Absolutely. We would love to have you on our volunteer force. We call it our Amazing Milwaukee Race Task Force. And we can always use volunteers. I mean, people who are excited about the city of Milwaukee and getting to go to local businesses, we would love to have you on our volunteer force. So you can go to our website, and there's a link there for volunteers, and you can email me, and we'll make sure that you get ready to go for our next event.
Awesome. And I know that there are also other like mini events leading up to this great race.
Mm-hmm. What we do, we did have a little bit, we had a kickoff event in May that was a lot of fun, just to give people a taste of what might be coming on this this next Amazing Milwaukee Race on Bikes. But we also, we thought it would be really neat, because the bike aspect to the race is new, that I really wanted to get into leading a regular group bike ride. So every Tuesday night at Roman Coin on Brady Street, which has been a great location for us in the past, we leave at 6 o'clock, and we normally ride for about 2 hours. And it's a really friendly, easy pace. It's a great group of people. And we normally ride about 15 miles. And it's a different route every week. So it's not quite like getting a bike race, but you might get a really good flavor of how my mind works when it comes to planning the route. And you'll see, well, just like last week, of course, it's themed. But last week, I remember we had a guy who had never biked with us before. He came to join us. And I asked him what his favorite part was. And I showed him the little connector, the little secret passageway on Jefferson Street, the Jefferson Tunnel that gets you from Clybourne to St. Paul. Jefferson Street stops, but you can actually go by foot between and underneath the interstate. Well, what that did is exactly what we go for, is that we are trying to expose people to places around Milwaukee that they didn't know existed. But for him, he said that that's going to make biking around downtown so much easier, knowing that there's that little 100-foot connector, instead of having to bike all the way down and around and back behind the art museum. So we try to show a little. Last week was a really fun ride where we did all the French street names for Bastille Days, but and then we have a really cool one next week. But I try to use the Milwaukee by Bike map so that you see it as a resource and you understand how to use the Milwaukee by Bike map, and how when you have a bike lane or we're looking for little ways to get around the city. And then I try to throw in fun stuff like, we do have our fun little secret passageways.
Well, Adam, it sounds like this race is going to be awesome. Good luck to you, and thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Stephanie.
Adam Bouse is the director and designer of the Amazing Milwaukee Race on Bikes 2, which will be held August 11th. There are still spots open to compete in the 15- or 30-mile courses and opportunities to volunteer. Bouse spoke with Stephanie Lecce. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Finally today, the U.S. Supreme Court's recent ruling on DOMA will have many far-reaching effects on our society. Essayist Avi Lank says not the least of those will be economic.
Back in the 1980s, when I was starting out as a business reporter, a juicy assignment came my way. Examine the impact of Wisconsin's tax laws on the state's economy. What I found was interesting and in its own modest way far-reaching. Many well-off older people were leaving Wisconsin for Florida, and not just for its sunnier climes. Florida's tax rates, for both income and estates, were much lower than Wisconsin's. And to make the situation even more interesting, Badger State officials were being aggressive about trying to prove that sunbirds, who split their time between here and Florida, were claiming Florida residences as a sham. The tax folks did this by checking such things as where snowbirds had banking accounts and what churches were listed on their tax forms as recipients of charitable deductions. As a result, savvy Wisconsin lawyers and accountants were telling clients to sever all traceable ties to the Badger State, even if they were spending 5 months a year here. I spoke to folks who had stopped giving to Milwaukee churches they had attended all their lives, closed all their Wisconsin bank accounts, quit civic clubs such as the Rotary, and even got fishing licenses as Florida residents, although they never cast a line. The Milwaukee Sentinel reprinted the resulting series as a pamphlet, and in a few years, Wisconsin's tax laws and policies were changed to make such legal and accounting advice less urgent. I thought about all of this recently after the U.S. Supreme Court made its ruling that the federal government must recognize same-sex marriages. The ruling leaves unclear many things, including the status for taxes and government benefits of same-sex couples who were legally married in a state such as Massachusetts, but who now live in a state that does not recognize such unions, such as Wisconsin. A practical result of the decision is clear for Wisconsin. Economically, it puts the state at a huge disadvantage. With the uncertainty around the real-life implications of the ruling in Wisconsin, savvy lawyers and accountants here will have to start echoing the advice they gave rich clients in the 80s, telling many gay couples they would be better off financially living in places like New Hampshire or Washington State that recognize same-sex marriage, or, if they stay in the Midwest, Iowa, which also does, or, as of next month, Minnesota, which will then. Illinois, too, has a strong movement to legalize same-sex marriage. The proximity of Wisconsin to Iowa, Minnesota, and Illinois makes the Badgerlands challenge even bigger. When it comes to employer-provided health insurance and Social Security benefits, gay couples will get a better deal in Des Moines and soon Minneapolis, and perhaps even in Chicago, than in Milwaukee or Madison. This is a strong incentive for a business looking to recruit employees nationally to locate outside of Wisconsin, for gay professionals to shun the state, or for a Waukesha gay couple approaching retirement to move. Many conservatives applaud Wisconsin's marriage laws, just as they deplored the state's tax laws in the 80s. Many liberals feel exactly the opposite. But both sets of laws had the same effect. They encouraged people to leave the state or not even settle here. And that hurts us economically and socially.
Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in Milwaukee Magazine and Corporate Report Wisconsin Magazine, among other places. And that's another week's worth of Lake Effects, produced by Mitch Tyke, Dan Harmon, and Stephanie Lecce, with Amy Kiley and our production assistants Eleanor Peterson, Gabby Magallanes, Nathan Royster, and Rachel Bloom. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, and also be back here with us again at 10 on Monday morning for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.